This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
It is 9 minutes after 11 o'clock. It is a Tuesday, and as you know, every Tuesday we focus on the Academic Digest. We try to bring scholars closer to the people. And those who do all the hard work and all the research, months if not years of thralling through books and literature and doing interviews and travelling, sometimes even travelling beyond the borders of the country, to put together their dissertations and eventually graduate. But as we do on Power Talk, we try to share it with you and share the wisdom with you. And today we have Kuda Vanyoro, who is joining us, part of our Academic Digest today, and the scholar that we're featuring today. And his dissertation, which was for his Master of Arts, the research was in Migration and Displacement Studies, the focusing on the blurred policy spaces and grey areas in between, exploring policy responses to cross-border migration and antiretroviral therapy treatment continuity in Johannesburg and in the Vembe district. So I'd love to hear from you as well, as part of the conversation that we're going to have now. Have you ever heard of the term medical xenophobia? Have you ever heard of the term medical xenophobia? Please do call us on 061-987-000, and you can also tweet at Aldrin St. Pierre, hashtag Power Talk, and tweet at PowerFM987. Kuda, good morning and welcome to Power Talk.
Morning, Arjun. Thanks for having me.
So quickly tell us about yourself. Utabugapi.
Well, Kuda Kwashe Vanyoro is a 28-year-old man who's currently doing a PhD at WITS. I am a Zimbabwean migrant myself, thus, and I began my journey in academia after completing my honours. I joined the African Centre for Migration and Society about 5 years ago, and I started doing work for them as well as a research communications officer, mm-hmm. really looking at the interface between research and policy, particularly around migration, which led me to be interested in some ways in notions of policy making, and using a case study of migration and health, I decided to explore the question of policy and migration and how migrants are affected or not by migration and health policies in South Africa and the Southern African region as a whole.
And with the other research that you've done, any specifics that you're focusing on?
The research I've done as well around research uptake focuses on how research contributes to policymaking in South Africa, particularly looking at migration as using the framework of unpopular causes, really thinking about migration as a very discrete topic that doesn't necessarily lend itself to the kind of analysis you would lend to any other issue. For example, we could give an example of housing or health, very mainstream issues that sit at the heart of citizen-state relations. Mm-hmm. And I try to explore how migration policymaking gets contested within the public sphere and amongst policymaking processes.
Does it really get contested?
It does, because we do know for a fact that the immigration policy framework that South Africa currently has in place is really, for example, oriented or skewed towards high skills, for example. And there isn't really, within the migration framework, there isn't really a provision for low-skilled migrants to move, and they end up moving irregularly. That is just one example. And this draws on particular assumptions and presumptions that particular forms of movement contribute to development, and some do not necessarily do so. Whereas, in fact, we see that in low skills and in informal economies, migrants are actually found. The Center for Development Enterprise, for example, did a study that found migrants contributing, I stand to be corrected, but a figure is around one out of five jobs, for example, in the informal economy. Mm-hmm. So it's all these tensions in the framing of migrant rights and also in policy making that doesn't necessarily hold itself to what empirical evidence suggests and what that suggests for how South Africa should be addressing migration.
And how does that then land in the health space, the health sector?
I think the health sector finds itself in this bubble of contestations over there's very dominant narratives that draw from, for example, assumptions that there is a human tsunami of migrants flooding to South Africa to access healthcare. There were narratives, I think reports, for example, of a bus of migrants full of pregnant women from Zimbabwe that actually did a kind of sensational rounds within the media without necessarily any empirical substantiation that could actually validate these claims. And in the migration and health space, the debate becomes also about, are migrants moving to access healthcare? If we are to reduce that debate to something other than a rights conversation, if we actually look at the numbers and look at what the even findings from other contexts suggest, you will find, for example, that migrants are found to actually be healthier than locals because there is what they call a healthy migrant effect in which there's a predisposition for particular, if you could call it positive selection, for particular kinds of able-bodied youth healthy to move into particular spaces to go and fend for the family and send money back. Same applies for, if I could refer to it as a kind of, in African cosmology, the idea that when one dies, they need to be rooted within their land. There's also a return home to die that has been found in other contexts where migrants are found, even those who've done interviews around the city of Joburg, are found to prefer to go and be buried home than and to actually get sick at home and repatriate at home. So you find that contestation playing it out that way, and then it becomes our job as researchers to show the different ways in which these narratives don't necessarily hold themselves to empirical scrutiny.
Interesting point that you just raised there about migrants who, well, I guess it's not just migrants, but just as Africans, this whole idea of being put back to the soil where you come from. And I know the connection that we normally make is, where is the umbilical cord buried? Because people would want to be closer to the umbilical cord. And I think it was a Checkpoint a couple of years ago that had a series, not a series, but it was an episode where migrants were traveling from, I think, Beitbridge, if I'm not mistaken, but with deceased people on board trying to cross the border. But the issue there was an issue around money. But it also speaks to this whole idea that I'd rather be buried in my home country than be buried in a foreign country. But then let's move on to your particular focus here, being on antiretroviral therapy treatment and focusing on what's happening in Johannesburg and what happens in Vembe.
Yeah, I think for me, those were particularly two interesting contexts to look at. Very much Joburg being a very much urban setting that also receives an internal a significant amount of internal and international migrants. And Messina, I mean, Vembe is the district, but the focus was on this town called Messina, which is literally 10 kilometers from the border, between the Beitbridge border between Zimbabwe and South Africa. So it is a space of high mobility as well, that way in which particular resources are also contested in similar ways that we see coming out in Johannesburg. So the aim of the study really was to try to explore using a bottom-up approach how there was this notion I was using of street-level bureaucracy that suggests that policy is actually not necessarily so much evident or manifest in its written form, but in its practical form. So we need to look at the practices of those healthcare providers or those actors on the front line to understand the true meanings of policy. So I tried to look at how healthcare providers responded to a lack of harmonization of treatment protocols, and you know, there's not also any guidelines around how to institute the continuity of care among different countries from in the region, for example. And even though South Africa has signed on to a protocol and that SADC has drafted, South Africa hasn't at the moment ratified that particular protocol. So this is a space where there isn't really much guidance about how to treat migrants who walk in a clinic without a referral letter. And also the structural issues around language. There's not really so much interpretation services, for example, in local clinics. And what does that mean for migrants when they walk in? So it was a particular space that I think engaged with all those complexities. And I tried from there to unpack how these responses speak back to assumptions that healthcare providers, for example, are necessarily xenophobic or exclusionary to non-nationals.
Actually, one of the respondents that you spoke to, unfortunately can't find the quote now, the question that you ask around policy and their understanding of policy. And I think she explained it, one of the nurses explained it as a contractual insurance or something along those lines. Can you just expand a bit on that?
Well, I think for me it was also and exposed in some ways how people actually understand policy making and policies differently, and how central these actors are to the efficiency or lack thereof of the healthcare system. The lady in question was actually referring to, when I asked the question around how she understood policy, referred to an understanding of policy as insurance, the way we use it in our everyday language of saying, do you have a policy, for example, to cover your funeral or to cover ABC? And you know, there's people who are known, for example, to sell policies in the street. She spoke of it in that way of thinking of it as an insurance and a contract. But I think hidden in that meaning is also this idea that there is some kind of social contract. I think that policy, I think there is an implicit meaning towards what the notion that policy has really binding regulations and binding clauses to it that, you know, we must always keep in mind as we do whatever we're doing in the work we do.
Yeah, because she also speaks about, I think she calls it a program, something along those lines. It's a program as well. Let's unpack this term that you used, medical xenophobia. And I guess this will then lead us to the experiences of some of these nurses, especially the ones in Musina.
Yeah, I think the term medical xenophobia was important because it really is used generally to refer to attitudes that healthcare providers hold on the job. There's one particular definition towards migrants, or attitudes that are aligned towards the further marginalization of migrants in through the healthcare institution. I think for me, when I was having conversations with my supervisor at the beginning of the project, one of the things she mentioned was there are experiences of discrimination that are happening in the public healthcare system. But she also mentioned how wary she was of such blanket terms that do not necessarily reflect the particularities of discrimination. And for me, that became an interesting take on thinking through how discrimination actually takes place and thinking through the specific public health care delivery elements to do with how care is negotiated amongst different actors. And this drew me to kind of realize how the centrality of the agency of healthcare providers themselves and the migrants in negotiating who gets access to what in particular moments. So once one hears a discourse of medical xenophobia, they get this, it has this totalizing effect that does not necessarily engage with the nitty-gritty mm-hmm. of inclusion and exclusion. Mm-hmm. How does it work, and how is mm-hmm. it mediated, and mm-hmm. how is it that particular migrants actually can tap into particular forms of citizenship, mm-hmm. Which I then move into when mm-hmm. I talk about therapeutic citizenship and bureaucratic incorporation.
Do you think that at all, that that because of the lack of policy understanding, that because of that, in how the nurses or the medical practitioners would respond to a patient, especially a foreign national, that could be construed as medical xenophobia? Because I think it's one of the clinics, I think, yeah. one of your respondents spoke about how, for instance, when it comes to ANC, one of the nurses would always insist on documentation, and this mm-hmm. person would then refer them to a. This is not the nurse who works in ANC, but one of the your respondents yeah. who says that they would then refer this patient to a different clinic, mm-hmm. this pregnant lady to a different clinic yeah. that would actually allow them to give birth there.
Yeah, I think certainly the question of who knows and understands policies is at the center of, and even though I feel it has also been overstated, because there are particular, I mean, healthcare providers actually, in as much as they might not know particular you know, exact clauses that are mentioned in particular acts and particular policies, they develop these de facto ways of responding, which become in some ways tacit norms that mm-hmm. are institutionalized in these spaces. So I think the role of policy, the critique that healthcare providers do not necessarily understand policy, also exposes the kind of faith we have in policy that has not necessarily materialized. If you look post-apartheid, if you also look at Zimbabwe, where I'm from, how policy does not necessarily translate into particular forms of practice. I think for me, the most crucial aspect in this example that you just raised about the administrator who said, who had to refer me to another nurse working in antenatal care, is also the notion of disease politics, or the notion of the specificities of particular diseases and illnesses, and the meanings that particular actors in society attach to them. I think HIV lends itself as well to a particular biomedical form of citizenship, which I could talk of it in the sense that healthcare workers then begin to work in a context where HIV, you know, the discourse in the public healthcare system is about, for example, targets. 1990 is one, for example, kind of global target that healthcare providers work towards. These framings, these global framings, also come to play a role in the priorities that healthcare providers put on particular bodies. Mm-hmm. So one then has to ask themselves, why is it that it's happening in antenatal care? Then you also start to unpack the symbolic meanings of giving birth in a foreign land, and meanings attached to when migrants want to have babies in particular spaces. What it raises a particular kind of a response because of the meanings that we attach to citizenship, as you know, is attached to land. I think in scholarship would refer to it as autochthony, the notion that the land is where the person belongs. So the meanings that have to do with belonging would certainly make some people uncomfortable about women giving birth in the clinic, but that does not necessarily mean that we can analyze similar relations such as HIV politics using the same lens. And I think that is the pitfall that the medical xenophobia notion has in not necessarily unpacking this various pockets of meaning and power. Yes.
Okay. So 0619870000. I'd love to have your take on the conversation that we're currently having. I'd love to speak to a nurse, perhaps, or nurses, people in the medical fraternity, those who have experience trying to administer medication to a foreign national What was that experience like? How do you go about it on a daily, whether you work in the city of Johannesburg, maybe you've worked in Vembe, or probably you've worked along the health facilities that are along the border lines of the country? What has that experience been like? And do you specifically have a clear understanding of the country's policies, and when it comes to when it comes to foreign nationals? Because one of the other aspects which we're going to raise just after Power News headlines for me is the Refugees Act, which specifically says that refugees are entitled to the same health care of a South African citizen, including those refugees or foreign nationals who are undocumented but are from SADC, right?
Yeah.
However, though, South Africa has become so complex, and the number of people who come into the country, we can't necessarily say that these are only people who come from the SADC region. Mm-hmm. However, though, these are human beings, and they still also need the medical attention. I'd love to have your take on it on 061-987-000. You can also tweet at Aldrin Simpier, hashtag PowerTalk, and tweet at PowerFM987. Another thing that I'd like to explore as well, that some of the respondents have spoken about, although you've indicated that there was no evidence to that effect, that is people coming to health facilities. This would now be undocumented foreign nationals coming to health facilities, getting the ARVs, but using two or three files even to get the ARVs. And the assumption is that they are actually reselling the ARVs, or they are taking the ARVs back home to somebody else at home who is suffering from the who has been infected with the same disease. There's also this idea, and which is something that we should unpack after Power News headlines, of who is this foreign migrant that we're speaking about? This cross-border migrant. Is this cross-border migrant somebody who's employed, or is it somebody who's unemployed? Because I think there's a class conversation to be had there as well. Because if you look at the stats that Kuda quotes or cites here, is that while the public health care sector spends 122.4 billion rand on 84% of the population, the private sector spends almost the same amount of 120.8 billion rand annually to cover only 16.2% of the population, which is about 8.2 million people. And these are figures from, I think it's 2009. No. You're citing Jobson here, and it's from 2015. So we'll be having that conversation just after this. 061-987-000. And you can also tweet at Aldrin Simpier, hashtag PowerTalk, and tweet at PowerFM987. We are in conversation with Kudo Vanyoro. We're speaking about his dissertation, which focuses on blurred policy spaces and grey areas in between, exploring policy responses to cross-border migration and antiretroviral therapy treatment continuity in Johannesburg as well as Vembe. I'd love to take your calls as well just after this. 061-987-000. It's time for Power News Headlines.
Speak up. Call the Power Line on 0861-987-000.
And you can also tweet at Aldrin Simpier, hashtag PowerTalk, and tweet at PowerFM987. We're in conversation with Kuda Vanyoro, who is a PhD candidate now, but we're focusing on his master's dissertation, focusing on the blurred policy spaces and grey areas in between, exploring the policy responses to cross-border migration and antiretroviral treatment and the continuity in Johannesburg as well as in the Vembe district. So let's just quickly take these calls on 061-987-000, and then we'll continue with our conversation. Masabato, good morning.
Good morning, Aldrin. I don't want to stifle debate, but, you know, I'm always intrigued by Zimbabweans doing, not just Zimbabweans, other foreign nationals as well, doing a lot of research to prove how xenophobic South Africans are. And sometimes I sit down and wonder whether they shouldn't be devoting all these resources into researching the collapsing health system in their own countries, particularly Zimbabwe, in order that the system serves them better and they do not find themselves having to migrate to South Africa and encounter xenophobia. So I think it would be a worthwhile exercise for them to focus on improving the health system in their countries of origin rather than waste time on whether there's xenophobia or not. Because fact of the matter is that South Africa is a constitutional democracy, so it is based on the rule of law. Therefore, it cannot be correct to say that every time a nurse says no, it means that xenophobic. It's not true. For example, I'm listening to him, and he uses he talks about refugees and migrants interchangeably. Mm-hmm. And the two groups of foreigners are regulated in terms of different legislative frameworks. We have the Refugee Act, which deals with refugees and asylum seekers. We also have the Immigration Act, which deals with migrants. So the two are regulated differently. For example, in terms of health care, the Immigration Act does not guarantee any illegal foreigner.
Masabata, we're losing you there. Hi, Masabata.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you now. Yeah, you can go ahead.
Yes, I was saying, if you look at the Immigration Act, it doesn't guarantee any illegal foreigner, which the media chooses to refer to as undocumented. There's no such in our legal lexicon. We talk about whether you are legal or illegal. So if you are illegal, there is no guarantee. It only guarantees the right to health care, emergency health care, to an illegal foreigner. So if it's not an emergency health care, therefore they are not entitled, which means that nurses could be having a point here if they refuse to grant, maybe to give medical care to somebody who is not in an emergency situation. That's why we have that case. But that case relates to refugees, because in terms of the Refugee Act, refugees and asylum seekers are guaranteed the right to basic primary health care. So if you go to, I think, is it the mother to child? No, it's Johannesburg Hospital that is involved in a matter involving a refugee who's seeking kidney treatment.
Oh, yes.
I can't remember what it is. So the argument, once again, but we're waiting for the Constitutional Court to pronounce, because the argument there is that in terms of our legislation and indeed in terms of all the protocols that government has signed internationally, they are guaranteed basic health care. Beyond that, they have to pay. So you cannot say that there's a law that allows illegal SADC migrants to access healthcare system in South Africa. There is no such. In South Africa, we do not have a law of special application. Our laws are of general application. So we do not give a dispensation to SADC nationals and not extend the same to nationals of other countries. If it's illegal, it's illegal across the board.
Okay.
So it is wrong to say that every time.
I think your point has been made. Thank you so much, Masabata.
Sure. I think
your point has been made. How do you then, Kuda, weigh that up with what the Constitution speaks about, Section 27, subsection 2, that no one may be refused emergency medical treatment? Yeah. Because the Constitution doesn't speak about no citizen may be refused emergency medical treatment. It says no one.
Yeah, I mean, these are the particular limitations of legislation in that these pieces of legislation that are extended to everyone are often come with clauses that maybe talk about, you know, this can be weighed within the context of available resources. And I think that's where the debates around emergency medical care also, I think, go boil down to. But I mean, just maybe to refer back to the caller, I think the very unique, I mean, certainly we would all love to have things being equal in the region, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Mozambique, Malawi. Unfortunately, the context that we find ourselves in and the actual regional context that we find ourselves in, which South Africa itself is very much a signatory to, is one in which we cannot talk about the nation state in isolation to other particular actors. And when it comes to public health, one should always keep in mind that diseases also know no borders. So what serves to benefit the public healthcare system of Zimbabwe is similar to what should serve the interests of South Africa, in that if you look back at the cholera outbreak in 2008 that took place in Zimbabwe, by the time the crisis had broken out and people were moving into the border to places like Messina, there were already documented cases and outbreaks of cholera. Yeah. I mean, one need also not make reference to Ebola and other contagious and other communicable diseases. So, I mean, in as much as we can always have discussions about what desirable political system we'd like to see, the reality is that one cannot disengage the public health welfare of the region or from South Africa itself. To do so would be, in fact, a disservice to the lives of South African people themselves, who come to contact with people who have moved in all these different risky ways. Yeah. The debate, I think, should be more about how do we document these people that are in this country who are. And not necessarily here, you know, there's a debate about criminality and the like, which we might not, which I wouldn't like us to get into, because it's a different kind of debate. But people who are generally in the country to contribute and looking for jobs, I was mentioning before we got on air, the fieldwork I'm doing, I'm looking at talking to Zimbabwean migrants who move informally, who are forced to cross the border informally because they cannot get passports from the Zimbabwean government right now. Because the country doesn't have enough paper to print passports, which is a whole diplomatic and political mess. And then they have to move informally. And when they come in the country, when you talk to them, the requirements or their needs are not really that luxurious. They are saying, we are here to look for jobs. We just want something to put food on the table, to be able to put our kids in school. So the regional complex, you know, doesn't really leave South Africa with much to choose from, except to act in an inclusive fashion, particularly when it comes to public health.
But what do you make about the point that she also makes, that if you are illegal, then you are illegal, and that's it.
Well, if that is the new principle of equality and liberty, or the new discourse in the post-apartheid dawn, then I stand also to be corrected about my positioning within that kind of society, because for me, I think morally speaking, and this is where the healthcare provider's empathy would come from, is because dealing with policymakers who speak exactly in that particular kind of language, these healthcare providers would have to then act within notions of moral deservingness, and looking at someone who's frail and dying at the particular site, and then to cynically just invoke documentation and legality. And I think earlier on you mentioned something, you asked me maybe to digress into the Messina space. When one looks at that border space, it's a very temporal space that is connected in very historical ways, where there are also ethnic ties between people who moved historically from Zimbabwe to South Africa. The connections that exist in those kinds of spaces could not allow those healthcare providers to simply say, because you do not have documentation, I'm going to let you die. And I think sometimes in particular spaces such as these ones, we tend to negate the fact that there are lives at stake, and someone could literally die.
Yeah.
Recently in my field work, when we visited a women's shelter to do some research there was a lady who had cancer. Womb cancer, and she said that one of the clinics, the clinics would always tell her to go to a hospital because her issue demands particular, you know, attention that's specific to this secondary institution of healthcare. And because of the fact that she did not have money and couldn't return to Zimbabwe, because in any case she wasn't getting help there because the public health care system there is struggling, she had resigned herself to simply wait and die while she was in that shelter.
Mm-hmm.
These are the particular lives that we should consider before we start to talk about lives in those in binaries of legality and illegality.
Sure. Actually, to that point, Mashomani just tweeted now, and I'd just like a quick response to this, and then we're going to move over to who are these migrants that we are speaking of. He says, wait a bit. So we are talking illegality, and the researcher invokes morality.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
Well, the limits of law, I think, is as a determinant of who gets access to what.
Mm-hmm.
I think we normally begin from normative points and prescriptions that do not necessarily engage with the realities of Black people,
mm-hmm.
Whether they be migrants or they be South African. And I think it goes down to the very foundations of South Africa itself, in which legal codes were used in ways that were meant to exclude and
mm-hmm.
And hold particular bodies to negation and contempt.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption that anything that is legal is right is flawed,
yeah,
in my perspective. And that is why morality, and it's not my language, it's a language of people who are on the front line,
mm-hmm.
who are using a particular ethics that transcends citizenship,
yeah,
to say because people are in help of medication or treatment, mm-hmm. And because HIV is also a disease that, yeah, affects the whole community, this, yeah, is how we're willing to respond.
I think that's a point that's made by one of your respondents as well, who says that just because you don't have an ID, what, should I leave you to die? These migrants that we are speaking about, or these cross-border migrants, who are they? In the social construct, as well as the class construct of South Africa, or even I think the continent, where do we place them?
Yeah. I mean, these migrants are people just like you and me who come in particular.
Mm-hmm.
In contexts that are impoverished, and that if one looks from the Zimbabwean context, it's spaces where the economy has failed, the politicians have failed to deliver the kind of economy that they, mm-hmm, had promised. And these are people who are located in a global context where there's so much happening around them. You think of, in my ongoing PhD work, I like to think of it in terms of time. These are people who are left behind in time in terms of development of their own spaces, development of their own lives, as women who are, for example, have to put kids into school, who have to take care of, as fathers who also have to take care of children and take care of their immediate family. So these are people who are trying to relocate themselves and reposition themselves from this kind of alienation from a developing world, from the world class, you know, African city. I would think of Joburg as a particular space, for example, that gives particular people rights, certain rights, mm-hmm. and these rights are fast becoming contested. And I think this speaks back to the notion that these are people who are just looking for a good life.
Yeah.
Within that, then there is always contestations about people coming into a space, and contestations about resources, and health becomes just one of many of these, mm-hmm. resources that become contested.
Yeah.
And you were mentioning earlier on the kind of class dynamic. It's also thinking about how the public healthcare system is emblematic of a system that was meant to keep Black people in servitude in particular spaces such as Bantustans, and mm-hmm. also kind of marginalizing them and relegating them to particular negative healthcare outcomes. So it is this milieu of people who are simply here to get a better life, and pretty much not so different from your average South African citizen, if I can use that terminology.
Okay, let's go to the power line, 0861-987-000. A tweet here from Abel, who says, your guest is, in simple terms, is trying by all means to morally blackmail South African public sector. Please ask, how does South Africa have limitless and indefinite resources? Lihle Honolo, good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
Good, good man.
Okay, yeah, my comment actually mirrors the one that you just read right now. I would like to ask the caller, why is it that African leaders in the region are excused, and then South Africans, we have to pay for this. It's our moral obligation to pay for this medical fee. And this guy, I'm happy that South Africa did well for him. He's a PhD candidate and all that. But why doesn't he dedicate some of his time actually to study the crisis in this country to find out how can we sort out this problem of people leaving their countries to come to South Africa?
Okay.
And then another thing that I want to mention to people is that people would like to say, no, South Africans were being assisted by these frontline states and other countries. But South Africans, when they were in exile, they stayed in camps. Everybody knows. They, you know, even if you need a doctor, you need to get a police clearance to go to a doctor on that day. You did not just move around opening business and all that. Believe me, I have no problem with that. But I think the problem is like the horses bolted in South Africa. Something needs to be done.
Okay, thank you so much, Lihle Honolo. Zamani, good morning.
Adrian, how are you?
Good, good, man.
Let me just be straight and simple. There's no such that South African citizens should be on par with foreign nationals. When we say foreign nationals, we don't pick up the race. What we're saying is that South African citizens' rights are human rights too, more than any foreign national rights in our country.
Is it possible to serve both, do you think, equally?
No, it's not possible. It's
Why?
Not possible because our budget won't do that. You know, when they do what we call Start SA. Start SA means that they do the number of people that are in the country, including those who are illegal, so that it can take care of those health systems. Now, in MCF, what we call that citizen first, we're saying there is no way that South African citizens can be in power with foreign nationals. We are going to fight this up until to the core. We're saying that the time has come. We are not going to tolerate this because our people are dying. Our people are seeing sharks in all of this because of this thing of promoting foreign nationals more than South Africans. We need our towns back. We need to expropriate them. As MCF, we say, expropriate our towns back from foreign nationals. We don't care they are black or white. As long as they are foreign nationals.
Legal or illegal? Okay. Okay. Kuda, how do you respond to those?
Well, I mean, I would really hate for the discussion to degenerate into, in some ways, radical, in some ways, hate as well driven discussion. I think my contribution in terms of the research that I did was to show the ways in which, particularly in a context where the system is designed to alienate particular people. Who are in this case non-nationals? How when there are people on the front line who are willing to use their innovation and creativity, they can actually contribute to the welfare and to positive public healthcare outcomes in South Africa's public healthcare system, which so happens to be a real cornerstone of South Africa's development agenda. Because, you know, you can only develop if you have a healthy population. And if South Africa envisages that non-nationals should contribute in one way or the other, in either low skills of the economy or scarce or critical skills, then health should certainly be a paramount imperative and consideration, because that is the only way in which people can contribute and in which South African society's public health itself can actually be one that is one we can look at without people, for example, losing their lives unnecessarily. It is not really for me a question of whether non-nationals are entitled to care or not. That is not the reason why I'm having this discussion.
This particular conversation.
I'm just mentioning the different ways in which, in contexts where the drive is to try to push people out, how mm-hmm. particular actors within the system can actually lead to transformation.
Okay, let's just quickly take this call from Temba, then we'll discuss some of your recommendations. Temba, good morning.
Hi, morning, Adrian and your listeners.
Sure, man.
Yeah, my point is that until we perceive the individual African state problem as an African problem, we're not going to win.
Mm.
Because country that does well, today it's South Africa that is better off than many countries in terms of the economy. Tomorrow it might be Nigeria. Tomorrow it might be Tanzania or whatever country in Africa. And the rest of the countries, chances are they won't be doing well. So as long as we perceive any problem that is that exists in Africa as an individual Zimbabwean problem or individual Nigerian problem, we're not going to win. We have to perceive ourselves as Africans. And unfortunately, we have an AU that is sleeping,
mm-hmm.
and we have regions that are sleeping. And it's these regions and the AU that are supposed to resolve these problems. We can't talk about resolving problems in South Africa only.
Yeah.
We have to talk about resolving problems in all individual African countries so that we don't have stress on our resources or on any country's resources that is coming up,
sure.
that is doing well.
Okay.
Rwanda is coming up, and I can tell you now, should Rwanda change things, change their economy around, tomorrow we may all, even including South Africans, flock to Rwanda to take advantage of their resources.
Let's not have that type of situation. Let's get every country to flourish. Kura, closing remarks and just quickly touching on some of the recommendations.
For me, I think the most important, valuable lesson from this work was really thinking about the usefulness of investing in grassroots responses to migration and mm-hmm. in responding to migration in ways that view public health as a good that each person should receive on the basis, if it needs qualification at all, can it at least be on the basis that it's good for everyone, that we have healthy migrants in communities entail a healthy community altogether, and while we wait for policy as well to engage with some of these questions of legality and illegality as citizens, there's ways we can contribute as people who are working in public service. There's ways that we can contribute to making the lives of South Africa, particularly through migrants as people who are part of that system.
Yeah.
To keep the country going forward.
Thank you so much. That is Kuda Vanyora, and good luck with your PhD.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.